You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Hello, everyone. My name is Gordon Peake. I'm the senior advisor on the Pacific Islands at the United States Institute of Peace. The United States Institute of Peace is a national, nonpartisan institute established by an act of U.S. Congress in 1984 to help prevent, mitigate, and resolve violent conflict. And we do that work by linking research, policy, training, analysis, and direct action to support those who are working to build a more peaceful, inclusive world. We work all over the globe, but in this hour that we're going to spend with each other, we're going to be focusing on the Pacific Islands, that more than dozen countries and territories spanning an area that is four times the size of the continental United States. The United States is increasingly focusing attention on the Pacific Islands, particularly amid China's growing engagement and the impacts of climate change. And the focus of this particular talk is on China's engagement and Taiwan's engagement in the Pacific Islands. And we're really fortunate to have one of the world's authorities on this matter to help talk us through these issues about recognition and derecognition of states and Chinese politics and Taiwanese engagement in the Pacific. This is Assistant Professor Graham Smith from the Australian National University, who has written widely about China in the Pacific. He hosts a terrific podcast series called The Little Red Podcast, which presents a really engaging and insightful take on China's rise and politics. And he also, for the purpose of, I think it's really useful to mention, Graham, that you're also a fluent Chinese speaker, so you're able to kind of get to places and to documents that maybe all of us, others of us, are not. So, Graham, it's wonderful to have you here.
Gordon, I'm delighted to be here. You demoted me to assistant professor. I'm actually an associate professor. There's a big difference.
But, okay. I should know my nomenclature right. I'd written down ASS in my notes, and I couldn't figure out for the life of me whether it's assistant or associate. Maybe after the call, you can tell us what the difference is. And what we wanted to ask Graham. We commissioned Graham to write a piece of commentary for us about the politics and the statecraft around the recognition and derecognition of states in the Pacific. So early this year, Nauru switched its recognition from Taiwan to China, which was presented as a big diplomatic accomplishment for Beijing and a poke in the eye for the new Taiwanese government that was elected in the same month. There were six Pacific Island countries in 2019 that recognized Taiwan as and now the number is half that. It is three, and there is much attention in February of this year to whether another Pacific Island nation, Tuvalu, that was also having elections, would switch also. So we kind of asked Graham to kind of look into the significance of this issue, of this recognition politics issue, and he delivered a terrific piece for us. People that are listening in, what we're going to do is we'll package together all the pieces that we're talking about in this call, and we'll put it together in an email for you afterwards. What I think the piece showed is that the story is much more nuanced and much more kind of broader than this headline tale of numbers going up or numbers going down. And so I'll be asking Graham to elaborate some of his thoughts. We'll speak for about 30 minutes, and then that allows, I think, 30 minutes for questions, comments, and perspectives. And I'd encourage all of you who are tuning in to put your questions in the chat function that you'll see on your screen, and colleagues will curate those questions and we will present them to Graham. I apologize in advance if we're not able to get to the question, but we really appreciate all your help, and for so many of you I know who are tuning in today. So Let's talk about the article, Graham, that we asked you to write about. And you put forward really a kind of trifecta of reasons for why China cares deeply about this recognition question, about trying to get more Pacific Island states in its ledger. And the first reason that you put forward is what you call telling China's story well, having pliable states in the international system who are able to speak for China at international forums. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about what you meant by that.
Yeah, look, thanks for maybe a bit of background before I get to the factors. I mean, what made us think about this was Nauru and the fuss being made over Nauru, which, after all, is the third smallest country in the world in terms of its population and probably also in terms of its landmass, an incredibly tiny place. And yet it was chosen to be the one to flip 2 days after the Taiwanese presidential election delivered the outcome that the Chinese Communist Party didn't want, and that was choosing the DPP, the slightly independence-leaning political party in Taiwan, choosing them to lead Taiwan for another 4 years. And so this was sort of punishment in a way for the Taiwanese voters choosing the wrong thing. Now, the irony of it is, of course, the Taiwanese voters really couldn't give a stuff about Nauru. And it had almost zero impact on them. So the question we were posing is, well, why do they do this? Why do they go to so much trouble over countries that their citizens haven't heard of? And the first one you raised there, Gordon, is sort of tied in factor one, which is international legitimacy and domestic legitimacy are kind of really tightly tied together, because telling China's story well, who are you telling China's story to? You're telling it to an international audience, sure, but your main audience is actually domestic. And when I say domestic audience, I mean Chinese citizens writ large, but even more important than that, the members of the Chinese Communist Party, who are predominantly who the propaganda apparatus is speaking to. Essentially, the party, if you want to imagine it, it's like an old man. He's been there for 70 odd years. Hard for you in America to imagine an old man staying past his time, but been there for 70 years. He's talking to himself and trying to convince himself that he's a great power. And that's not to say China isn't a great power, but the storytelling that goes on around this is a really key part of it. It has to do with UN votes. So the UN, you know, if you like, bending to China's will. And the more countries you can get on board, the more UN votes you're likely to win. On controversial hot button issues within China, like Hong Kong, Xinjiang, Tibet, if you can rally a large number of countries to support your position, also in the South China Sea, then that plays well domestically to your Communist Party audience and to your domestic audience. And it's a real different thing in a way under Xi Jinping, a different level, because in the past, China ran a mile from the idea that it had something to offer the world in terms of a model of governing. There was this term called the Beijing Consensus that Hu Jintao and his administration just hosed down and said, no, we're not, China's unique. We're not going to export our development model. That's totally flipped. Now they have the confidence in every area, even in the rule of law, poverty alleviation, to sell China's model to the developing world and say, this is the way you become rich. So that's sort of factor number one.
So you know, you've got the Nauruan ambassador in Beijing would be pretty busy trying to prosecute this case. Nauruan diplomats abroad would be busy trying to prosecute this case as well.
Well, I mean, there's so many people now in China's camp that they get to take turns in a way. You know, like, who's going to support what we've done in Hong Kong today? You know, okay, Papua New Guinea, it's your turn. So they definitely do get to sort of take turns. And some countries are more useful than others, and some leaders are more useful than others. Certainly, Sogavari outdid himself as a model of what you should look like when you flip to China. I mean, he was a conduit in a way they couldn't have dreamed of.
Yeah, I hope we get to talk about Solomon Islands and Sogavari and the new prime minister later. But another reason that you put forward in the article for why recognition and by that sort of an increased presence in these Pacific Islands states, which are, as you say, some are small in territory, but large in exclusive economic zone, relates to policing of Chinese citizens. So you mentioned Solomon Islands. Solomon Islands and China signed a security pact, which created a lot of headlines, a lot of discussion about what are the implications for the United States, what are the implications for Australia, you being in the capital, Canberra. I mean, a lot of, you know, the cliche of the ink being spilled on this. But your argument was is that the people that have the most to get consternated about, the people who have most to get worked up about, is not necessarily other states, but Chinese citizens that are abroad in what was previously an area that would have been out of the control of the Chinese state. There's a great line in your article about how Chinese business people in Honiara, whenever you went to talk to them, were really not that keen on this idea of a shift, which seems kind of counterintuitive when you first look at it. But I'd love you to talk more about that and also the sort of policing component as well, because there's a lot of focus on Chinese police in the Pacific. Grateful for your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and you work on policing as well, of course. So yeah, we have actually written a paper together, which I hope is in the briefing pack you're sending out, because that was a...
We'll have to find it. Yeah,
that was a pleasure to write that one. So it's quite a recent thing under Xi Jinping, in that the whole way that China views its citizens abroad has changed, and changed not just in a sort of a waffly philosophical sense, but actually in an administrative sense. So in the past, Chinese citizens used to come under the jurisdiction of this thing called the Office of Overseas Chinese Affairs, which essentially was about encouraging Chinese citizens abroad to invest into China, to take their money and invest in China. And in many ways, that was the secret sauce in China's economic miracle, because overseas Chinese were much more effective investors into China than any other group. They knew how to do it, they knew who to contact, and they understood how the system worked. So they outdid Americans, Australians, anyone else that tried to invest in China. Overseas Chinese were really the key to China's miracle. But in 2017, 2018, that all shifted when this office was put under the control of the, and basically disappeared into an organ called the United Front Work Department, which is a party organ. And essentially its job is to, it has two buttons. It has coerce and co-opt. And essentially these are the two things this robot can do. And if you're a Chinese citizen in Honiara, you are expected to be a diplomat for China. Essentially, you're meant to, you know, promote China's image abroad. Now, anyone who's been to Honiara in Chinatown will see that that's not what these guys are about. They're about making money as fast and as loose and as quickly as possible. So the Chinese state is very much fixated on control and extraterritorial control. The new slogan, and again, extremely new, is this thing called Shi Wai Fa Zhi, foreign related rule of law, which has a defensive component, thanks to the United States to having its extraterritorial laws that they try to apply to Chinese citizens. But it also has, if you like, an external aggressive component to it, which is about governing Chinese citizens outside of Chinese borders and effectively treating them as though they are in China. And you see this in some of these extraordinary policing operations, mostly in Southeast Asia, but occasionally they pop up in the Pacific. We had this instance in Fiji where there were 77 Chinese citizens hooded up, put on a China Southern airplane and flown back to Changchun. This was all done under the rubric of a police cooperation agreement that they had with the Bainimarama government. But the legal mechanism just wasn't there. And they've been doing this quietly throughout the Pacific. It doesn't always make the headlines because it's in no one's interest to publicize it. But in Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu, it happens really quite regularly that Chinese citizens are rounded up at the behest of the Chinese authorities and flown back to China without any due process.
Yeah, and it goes, as you say, goes often away from the cameras. But I mean, that you reference this footage that appeared in Fiji, and I think there was still footage in Vanuatu of people being marched onto planes and being sent sent to China. And I was in Port Moresby recently, and what's striking is almost people are talking up where, again, where there was a discussions about a China Papua New Guinea policing pact, which got everyone exercised as well. And what was really striking about it was people would talk about the almost the Chinese police that are there already, that are but are in informal police, not in uniforms like that you maybe see in Solomon Islands, but they're in an informal sense as well. So that was a really helpful sort of primer on what's in the paper. And as you said, a lot of this being bound up with international, the story abroad is also bound up with the story within as well. And there's a really interesting theme, I think, in the paper about the kind of soft underbelly of maybe insecurity that kind of permeates that as well. I want to turn to, Graham, to we mentioned one of the states already that still recognizes Taiwan, Tuvalu, but I want to also look at the two other states that recognize Taiwan, which is the Republic of the Marshall Islands and the Republic of Palau. So two of the three freely associated states that the United States is sort of probably most focused on within the Pacific because of the unique defense and economic relationships that it has with these three countries. So a few years ago, before I joined USIP, we published, so I can get no credit for this, but the rest of some of the other colleagues have, we published this study group report on countering Chinese influence in the freely associated states, which recommended an elevation of US engagement with the freely associated states, and had a really interesting line in it, which said, and I'm going to quote from the report, where it said, and again, we'll put all this in the chat, is Beijing sees Pacific Island nations as a low investment, high reward opportunity for China to score both symbolic and tactical victories in the global agenda. So with my colleague, Camilla Poli, who writes a lot of our really excellent material on the Pacific Islands, we made a trip to two of the freely associated states. Last year, we went to the Federated States of Micronesia, where the previous president, David Panuelo, had got attention for writing a letter talking about Chinese influence in his country. But we also visited Majuro, the capital of the Marshall Islands, and there were stories that had never emerged into the newspapers. So the Marshall Islands, it recognized China up until 1990. And when the Chinese embassy closed, the Chinese government continues to have a sort of presence or a quasi-presence of these caretakers that are there to take care of the embassy building. And we were learning during our time there that these caretakers were in many ways acting as kind of unofficial diplomats in the Marshall Islands, and were conducting meetings about trying to move that recognition lever from a ledger from Taiwan over to Beijing. And there's also that sort of report that did emerge of a Chinese businessman, Carrie Yan, who bribed Marshallese legislators in not a lot of money, actually, took to do the bribe, from what I remember, but to establish a autonomous region on Rongelap, which is an atoll very close to Kwajalein, one of the big US military bases in the freely associated states. It was an unsuccessful endeavor, but I think it showed the vulnerability of the RMI government to bribery. Where we didn't make on our trip last year was to the Republic of Palau. There's going to be an election in Palau in November. Palau is one of the two of the freely associated states that recognizes Taiwan. I'd love to get your thoughts sort of looking forward on Palau. Is recognition politics going to be a factor in the election? Love to get your thoughts on what's happening there. It's also, I know it's a region that, it's a country that you yourself have done some sort of fascinatingly, reads like a kind of like John Le Carre novel, some work that you did on Palau and some sort of Chinese influence operations that were going on there. So I'll put the quarter in the meter. Over to you.
Thanks, Gordon. Yeah, no, I'm really glad you mentioned Carrie Yan in the Marshall Islands, because, I mean, in many ways, they're sort of the prototype of these grifters who, you know, in order to inoculate themselves from being investigated by the Chinese authorities, make themselves useful to China. And they very nearly made themselves incredibly useful by flipping the Marshall Islands over to away from Taiwan and towards Beijing. But in Palau, you have these similar intermediaries that are very interesting and will, I think, play a role in the election. The current president has, you know, very clearly said there's going to be interference and we need to be on the watch for it. Certainly his Taiwanese intermediaries he'll be talking to there are the most qualified in the world to talk about Chinese disinformation during elections, because, you know, anything China does elsewhere in the world is nothing compared to what they do in advance of a Taiwanese election. The extraordinary stuff. I mean, they literally flew over 1,000 local politicians in Taiwan across to China to kind of on subsidized travel to see the China miracle in advance of the presidential elections in order to sway their votes. So, you know, whatever is done in the Pacific will be a very small fraction of what gets done to Taiwan. Now, he's the president's running against Tommy Rumengensau, who was staunchly pro-Taiwan while he was in the job. But while out of power, he's been approached by intermediaries, particularly this guy called Hunter Tian, who made an effort and was at the heart of this effort to sway the leading newspaper of the country to publish pro-China content and basically to kind of act as an intermediary on China's behalf. Now, he was involved in this group that you've described as a bit like a Le Carre novel. The report is written by OCCRP, the Organized Crime Corruption Reporting Project, and I recommend you read the whole report. My role in it was essentially just to do a little bit of digging. So I had a pretty small role in the report. OCCRP gets the credit for it. There's a reason I wasn't in my byline's not there in it. But in the digging part of it, we found this entity nominally based in Hong Kong, but involving, I think, upwards of 40 different entities, many of them with links to, for want of a better word, China's espionage institutions, espionage for profit institutions. It was an incredible, elaborate conglomerate that was trying to interfere with Palau's media. Now, in the end, it failed and failed quite spectacularly. But recognition is going to play a role regardless because of tourism. So Palau is one of two Pacific nations, along with Fiji, that is really highly dependent on tourism. It's about 40% of their GDP. And the numbers since since China started to play hardball back in the late 2010s, the numbers just haven't recovered. And so there is an economic argument for the switch, which people feel. You know, the numbers are not back to where they were. The tourists coming in from Japan and Taiwan aren't enough to match these massive Chinese group tours that used to come to Palau. So it's going to play a role, if only because the president's going to make it an issue.
Great. Thanks, Graham. I was typing in the chat as we were talking, which we're trying to queue up some questions, which we'll come to in a little bit. So thank you to everyone who submitted a question, and I'd invite others who are, shy typers to put your message in the chat. We mentioned Manasseh Sogavare earlier on in the conversation, former Prime Minister of Solomon Islands, presently the finance minister in the Solomon Islands, and the present Prime Minister of Solomon Islands, Jeremiah Manele, is off to Beijing presently. He visited Australia last week, which was sort of presented as being a kind of win for Australia because he visited there first. But I think that gets into something that my colleague Camilla Poli wrote about, which is the kind of politics of sort of high-level meetings. The politics and the diplomacy and the personal relationships that come with kind of entertaining leaders. So I remember with former Prime Minister Sagavari, who's a devout Seventh-day Adventist, a lot of the trip that was that he made, it fell over the weekend. Seventh-day Adventists can't work on the weekend. So the China changed his schedule and allowed him to visit an SDA church on the Saturday. So I think it kind of gets to, you know, to the how the finesse and the thought that goes into this. I lived in Papua New Guinea for many years. There was a large delegation often of Papua New Guinean politicians and Bougainville politicians where I lived that would go off and what they would sometimes euphemistically call sightseeing tours. But Camilla had this great paragraph, the lead of the paragraph in the piece. Now, I want to sort of read that out to you and get you to reflect on her observations about the importance of meetings. So I'm quoting now, and it says, quote, "If the US government wants an edge over China in the Pacific Islands, it needs to facilitate more meetings between the President of the United States and regional leaders, preferably one-on-one. When Pacific Island leaders fly to Beijing, they often have a one-on-one meeting with the Chinese president. But such a meeting between the leader of a Pacific Island country and a sitting president of the United States has never taken place. The White House has only conducted joint meetings with Pacific Island leaders. Sometimes even joint meetings don't make the cut." And Camilla wrote the piece, I think it was sort of 4 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, when some of the leaders in the Freely Associated States were meant to come to Washington for a kind of collective meeting as well. So really love to get your sort of thoughts on how much diplomacy and elite diplomacy involves catering to the elite, because it's Camilla's argument, and I think it's a kind of really, really good one, is that this is something that China does better than the United States.
Well, and better than Australia as well, I've got to say. I mean, when I think people in Canberra finally woke up to the fact that this is something China does well and something that's pretty cheap. Like, this is the thing. It doesn't cost a lot of money to host a few parliamentarians and have them meet with your head of state. It's a pretty cheap win in a way. And China's been doing this better than us for a long, long time. I remember we went back to the history books, and when the leader of Vanuatu was coming to Australia, we had a look back and we're like, when was the last time a Vanuatu head of state was invited to Australia? And it was 1994. I mean, sure, Vanuatu has a revolving door of politicians, but, you know, they've all been prime minister at least four or five times. So, you know, if you invite the right guy, you know, if he's not prime minister this week, he'll be prime minister next week. So it's something that China does incredibly well. And they do it at all kinds of levels. As you were pointing out, it's not just the heads of state. They'll target, for example, the chiefly organizations in Vanuatu and in Fiji. And you'll see these guys, you know, sightseeing is one word for it, but they really get treated well, and, you know, shown the sights, place, China's nicest places, if you like Hangzhou. But they're also, as part of the tours, often sold the development model. They'll be taken to places like Yunnan in the southwest of China and shown, look, you know, here's what you know, large-scale infrastructure can do to transform your economy. You too can have this. The pitch is at all kinds of levels of government, not just heads of state. And we've got a way to catch up on that.
Shopping too. I mean, I remember an East Timorese police officer sort of contrasting a visit to the winter in the southern hemisphere to, and I've sort of forgotten which country he was visiting, with the more mercantile focus of his trip to China. We've got some questions that are here, Graham. We could talk for a little. I'd love to get you talking a little bit more about policing and kind of how do we think about responses to the type of police extraterritorial actions that are going on in the Pacific. But thank you to everyone who's contributed some questions from the chat. So I'm going to begin with Adam Bubanich. Thank you, Adam. And the question is, how can the United States and its allies sell its development model to developing countries, which often requires reforms on the part of the receiver without compromising human rights. So, important question, given that the United States has a Pacific Partnership strategy with which was announced a couple of years ago. But sometimes there's a perception that perhaps not with that strategy, but almost a general perception that when you and I are both Australian citizens, but like when a government has a development project that comes with a sort of you must do it this way type of thing, whereas I think Adam's question is getting to the how can it do that, which often requires reforms on the part of the receiver, which I think is the critical part of Adam's question. So over to you, Graham.
Yeah, look, it's a great question because it gets to the heart of a really difficult problem for the United States and also for Australia. And in many ways, if you're viewing, you know, the Chinese approach as a grand strategy, what they've been doing is they've been looking throughout the world. Well, where are the places that the West is neglecting? Where are the places that the West isn't? And they're finding countries like the Solomon Islands where, you know, quite simply, the attention just wasn't there. One of the more comical moments when Solomon Islands was switching away from Taiwan towards Beijing, Marco Rubio, I think it was, got up in Congress and that would have been the Senate, I guess, and thundered that, you know, America would cease all of its aid to the Solomon Islands. And then someone checked the books and was like, well, how much aid does America give to the Solomon Islands? And it transpired that it was less than $1 million a year. And China had on the table $500 million. So it was really a case of, you know, bringing in not so much a knife, but more a kind of a small toothpick, perhaps, to a gunfight. So there is that conundrum is how do you compete in parts of the world where, you know, there are real governance problems, there are problems with the nature of the regime. And in some cases, I don't know how you go there, because take a country like Eritrea, for example, how do you deal with a regime like that without going well beyond your baseline of your core values as a democracy? How do you approach it? It's an incredibly tricky problem. The choices aren't that stark in the Pacific. By and large, we have democracies, we have peaceful societies with their problems for sure. So in the Pacific, at least, it is, we could dial back a little bit, I think, on the governance requirements, not to the point of putting money into the MPs' bank accounts and telling them to go spend the money, but certainly the lecture on good governance, it's wearing a bit thin in some Pacific countries. By the same token, there are other Pacific countries that have internalized it and kind of turned it back on us in many cases. So it's not a one-way street.
You mentioned putting money into MPs' bank accounts, and that is a reference to what in Solomon Islands and in Papua New Guinea are collective noun is constituency development funds, where more and more money is being given to members of parliament to conduct, you know, what's euphemistically called service delivery, to provide services. And the origin story of that is actually, Beijing is doing that now with Solomon Islands members of parliament, but I think the origin story of these constituency development funds, which get a lot of development practitioners and kind of good governance advocates aghast, because you're giving a large proportion of the budget of the state to MPs to do this, and there's what's the euphemism, like variable levels of accountability for how those funds are spent. The origin of that, if I remember correctly, Graham, from reading one of your pieces, is Taiwan.
Yeah, in the Solomon Islands is Taiwan. In PNG, they came up with it themselves, but it wasn't such a big problem until recently. And the Taiwanese, you know, came up with these things, and every time a Taiwanese ambassador left, he would wring his hands and say, we really should do something about the corruption that these funds are causing, and we really should get rid of this. But when it came to the switch from Taiwan to Beijing, the first question, and really the only question the MPs had of Beijing, is, you're going to keep giving us the money, right? And now you've seen in Solomons this incredible flourishing of the Constituency Development Fund ecosystem, and you've gone from having one fund to now three separate funds, all of which have a differing degree of discretion of, if you like, the ruling party's control over them. And so the Chinese were kind of flummoxed when they arrived in Solomon Islands. They didn't really know what to do with this, because they weren't going to put the money straight into the MP's bank account. So what they tried to do is they tried to set up 50 separate aid projects in the 50 different electorates. And they even went to the Brits and said, holy crap, we have 50 different aid projects. Can you give us some monitoring and evaluation software so we can keep an eye on this money? And I think in the end, they've thrown their hands up and gone, look, you guys sort it out yourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I know monitoring and evaluation is a very specialist technical skill, but I mean, that might stretch even its most impassioned practitioners towards. It's also a good reminder of where governance innovations come from. Like that came purely from Taipei originally, and it's something that has, like all ideas, has kind of spread around, certainly through Melanesia. A question from Tina Chung from the Voice of America Chinese branch. You've got these questions in your group chat, Graham, if you look at it as well, but I'll read it out for everyone else, which is, a Taiwanese official said today the DPP government is planning a presidential trip to its diplomatic allies and whether to transit the US. What impact could this trip have on cross-strait relations? There always seems to be a variant of this, making a trip, not making a trip feature. I realize it's 6 a.m. in the morning, so you may not have caught up on the story in Canberra, but just love to get your sort of some thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, the Taiwanese officials going to the US always ramps things up to a whole different level. One of the previous instances of a Taiwan ally being flipped was Honduras, and they flipped Honduras at the exact time that Tsai Ing-wen, the previous Taiwanese leader, was in the US, and it was done very clearly to punish her for going to the United States. Look, I think it's going to make things tricky. I haven't had a chance to look at the news, but certainly Beijing is very much trying to get the measure of the new Taiwanese president, and it's a very fine distinction. He seems to be a Republic of China guy. He likes to talk more about the Republic of China than Taiwan. He uses that word a lot more than his predecessor. And he does seem to have a slightly different approach to cross-strait relations than his predecessor, but you're really getting into the weeds almost of constitutionality when you talk about these differences. They're very, very nuanced differences. But if he goes to the US, then yeah, you're going to see a lot more activity in the Taiwan Strait, that's for sure.
This also kind of gets to the question of sort of visits and the sort of politics around visits. So Taiwan exited from Solomon Islands, exited from Nauru, exited from Kiribati. Has there been any Taiwanese presence, or is it just since the switch? Or is it just like the building shackled up? That's the end of the matter. I mean, I'm sort of thinking of the question that Tina posed about how much visits into other people's territory kind of generates concern, political concern and sensitivities. Is Taiwan still interested in those specific island countries, or is it just kind of like, well,
That's a really good question, Gordon. Short answer is, it depends on the country. So if a country is seen as a regional player, such as Fiji and such as Papua New Guinea, the Taiwanese are going to make efforts in those countries. And Fiji is probably the country they make the most effort in the Pacific. And you saw that after the new government came in, they were very excited in that the the words that were used to refer to Taiwan were changed by the incoming government, but then a few months later changed them back, I think, to something like Chinese Taipei or whatever they, whatever the formulation was. But this, in countries like Nauru, they leave, literally don't bother to, you know, to change the light bulbs kind of thing. Solomon Islands likewise, because they don't see these countries as important geopolitical players. Where Taiwan's main effort is these days is not its allies. It's the United States, it's Australia, New Zealand, even to some extent, because these are the countries that it sees as being able to provide protection for it. In the event of something more serious coming from across the other side of the Taiwan Straits. So Taiwan has limited diplomatic resources. They're not going to waste any of them in places like Nauru.
So there's no caretakers at the embassy in Yarit?
Certainly not. And given that Nauru is flipped not once but twice, I think they would almost be at the point where they... If they did get the phone call, they'd be like, you can get stopped.
You mentioned something really intriguing, and this sort of gets into your monitoring and kind of ability to read sort of Chinese language newspapers and media sources. And you said something intriguing at the beginning of our chat where you said, well, it wasn't a factor in the election in Taiwan. People in Taiwan weren't really that interested after the switch. Is there any, what is the degree of commentary in Taiwan and in China? And I'm conscious that there's like that there's a sometimes sort of strictures on free speech in this conversation. But does the Pacific Islands feature large or loom large in, you know, commentary about the thing? And the reason why I'm saying is like, you know, you're in Canberra, which is where there's ever more of an arc light of focus on the Pacific Islands. You're part of the Department of Pacific Affairs, which is sort of focused on it. In Washington, D.C., where I am, it's a place which is getting, it's a region that is getting more and more attention. Is there similar levels of attention in China and Taiwan, whether it be within the kind of think tank community, within the kind of institute community, within academia, within popular discourse, or is it a far away off region of which we know nothing, to sort of paraphrase Winston Churchill in the wrong way?
Well, there's different levels of attention depending which bit you're talking about. So in terms of public recognition, it's easy to measure in both countries. China doesn't care what its citizens say about the Pacific, and they're free to say whatever they want on WeChat and Weibo and any platform. They don't bother to censor that sort of stuff. And there's almost a unity position on Taiwan's allies and the switching of Taiwan's allies, which is if any country is still with Taiwan, they are small, brown, and poor. And this is what you hear both sides of the Taiwan Strait. And in some ways, to be a Taiwan ally is almost to be, the cheating lover who hasn't been found out yet on the Taiwanese side, and the wife that came to us not in time on the Chinese side. So there's no love really either side of the Chinese of the Strait for Taiwan's allies amongst the general public. We dug into Chinese social media in the aftermath of the Nauru switch, and you had some netizens who were like, yeah, this is great, you know, that's a real poke in the eye for Taiwan, but you had other netizens who were looking into it and going, hang on, this is the third smallest country in the world. They've already switched once and switched back again. And then they dug into the country and found the weird colonial history of Nauru and pronounced it things like an empire of poop digging and all kinds of things. So yeah, in popular discourse, it features generally negatively. In the think tank world in China, there is increased resources being pushed towards Pacific studies and Pacific languages as well. You can learn pretty well any Pacific language you want now, even Cook Island Maori, should you choose to learn it. And one of my PhD students is one of the instructors over there. He speaks fluent Fijian, and yet has never set foot in Fiji. So, there is an effort on the part of the Chinese state, and there are Pacific curious Chinese citizens, to be sure.
Great. The question here from April Herlevy. It's a terrific question. Thank you, April. And the question is for, and it really kind of gets to the kind of nub of the matter, for the US and Australian foreign policy in the Pacific Islands, how much do you think the diplomatic recognition competition between China, Taiwan really matters? So like, you know, on a scale of like 1 to 10, 1 being it doesn't matter at all, and 10 it's something that gets the cable machine clanking. How much does this diplomatic recognition competition matter for, you know, the U.S. Foreign Service officer, the U.S. ambassadors that are they're posted out there, their Australian equivalents?
This is sort of adjacent to the question I was tackling in the paper, and it's a really interesting one, because if you look at it historically, Australia used to view Taiwan in the Pacific purely as a nuisance. This is when we had a very different view of China, of course, but certainly under the government of Kevin Rudd, which isn't all that long ago, Kevin Rudd now being your ambassador there in Washington, he just saw the Taiwanese as a pest, and more or less, you know, if they all switched at once back then, he would have been delighted, you know, because the checkbook diplomacy that was going on, resulting in things like the Rural Constituency Development Fund in the Solomon Islands, resulting in bribing of individual politicians, was really making all these governance efforts almost pointless. So we've really shifted from seeing Taiwan as a nuisance to seeing Taiwan as kind of a bulwark, if you like, against Chinese influence. And it's a really tricky thing, because in countries where you don't have the Chinese state, what you often get are proxies. And sometimes these proxies are even more troubling than the formal Chinese state. So in Palau, you had figures like Broken Tooth Koi, this former head of the 14K triad, basically going into Palau and trying to set up these massive casino ventures and trying to influence Palauan politics. I mean, meeting with figures like Tommy Remengensau and really trying to shift the dial a bit. In Marshalls, you talked about Carrie Yan, these grifters who go into town. There's no Chinese embassy there to give them any grief, so they can operate in a gray zone beyond the reach of the Chinese state. By the same token, once a Chinese embassy presence is established now, they will, you know, be a very different proposition to an embassy that was established, say, back in the 1970s in Fiji. They'll start on the front foot because they want to get noticed. You know, we've opened the embassy, let's make an impact. And so you see things like the policing cooperation agreement in Solomon Islands. You see things like, quite extraordinary performances by Manasseh Sogavare. Sure, that was mostly his own doing, but certainly the embassy in the Solomon Islands has been on the front foot in a way that other embassies throughout the Pacific just are not.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the sort of policing there, and it kind of recalled to mind, I think it was probably about 10 years ago, lots of consternation in Canberra about Taiwanese policing that was going on there was a proposal to set up a Taiwanese policing program in Honiara, and there was lots of kind of consternation about it as well. And I love that word that you use, bulwark. I think it's a very, very evocative one. Let's talk a little bit about policing. As you said, it's something that I began my career working in. I've done a podcast series, and I was lucky to have Graham on the podcast on an episode that we did about policing in the Pacific. And as you can tell by listening to Graham, Graham's a very garrulous and engaging speaker. But I think the best line that was said in that podcast series was by a former senior Australian police officer who was the head of the participating police force in Solomon Islands. His name was Dennis McDermott. And he said, you know, if you went to the dark side of the moon, you would find a Pacific police force being trained there. And he was talking about the ubiquity of training that is going on in the Pacific. And almost every month, at least, there seems to be a new announcement of an enhanced police training program somewhere in the Pacific. There was Australia's announced a college for Pacific Island Police to come to Brisbane to train it. So it's an extremely well-trained set of police institutions in the Pacific. And I think, as you and I have traveled, when you go into police headquarters in the Pacific, what you see are there's more certificates on the wall than there are books in your bookshelf back there of people have visited. But if we take what you're saying about Chinese extraterritorial policing, to its logical conclusion, then a lot of this training that seems to be offered to Pacific police forces, which is, you know, based on the idea that, you know, how do you investigate something better, or here's a car in which to drive better, really doesn't get at the nub of the matter, because the nub of the matter is elite politics in a way, and it involves a lot of, you know, that and involves, you know, diplomatic relations between states. So thinking about the offer that Western states make in the Pacific, which is a very samey offer for more training, more equipment, more advisors, doesn't strike me, and I think we wrote a piece on this, doesn't strike us as getting to the nub of the matter. But is there anything that the United States or Australia or kind of other sort of partners can kind of think about in order to try to sharpen their offer better? Or is it just the nature of diplomacy that you should just have a police development program, whether it does it or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these tricky ones in that the products being offered are so different that, you know, you don't want to shape your product to look like the Chinese product, because, you know, it's a totally different thing in the window. I mean, what China is offering to the elites is essentially, rather than being an external security partner of choice, what they're offering is to be your internal security partner of choice. So if you have problems with domestic ethnic unrest, if you have problems with certain communities, we will give you a new method of policing, which is mostly about social control. That is mostly about enabling police forces to act very firmly against their own people, rather than positioning yourself like the US does as largely an external security partner of choice. And in the Pacific, it's not as shifting of the dial as it might be, say, in Africa and other places where you do have massive civil unrest and the provision of, say, a Chinese form of policing to a state like Eritrea is deeply, deeply disturbing in a way that it isn't as yet in the Pacific. So if you're providing ways of social control, if you're providing surveillance equipment, this is, I think, even though, if you like, it's a Chinese innovation, it's not an innovation I think we necessarily want to match. Because once you start to get into a bidding war around, well, you know, we'll give you even better surveillance equipment to keep an eye on your resident populations, then we end up in a very, very dark place indeed.
And have you noticed any percolation of this sort of Chinese policing offer? Is there one country that sort of stands out to you as being an example of, well, it's further along the road, or is it too early to tell, or is it, are Pacific police forces doing what police forces all around the world have done for external reform efforts, which is to kind of thank you very much and then sort of not pay very much attention to what was given? Have you noticed that the Chinese offer has been taken up with any form of alacrity?
It really varies according to different countries. I mean, the one that people don't talk about so much, but is kind of more interesting, is Fiji, because the Fijian agreement, which was signed way, way back in 2011, and has since been, you know, since come to light, and we know, we can see the full text of the document, unlike the Solomon Islands agreement. It does read like it was hammered out between the two sides. It's not this boilerplate thing that Beijing has foisted onto Fiji. And it does get to the heart of some really serious issues that Fiji faces, and issues that have only got more serious since the agreement was signed, around transnational crime, particularly around drugs. And the whole nature of the drug scene has changed since 2011. We've moved from a situation where, you know, you have spillage, I think they called it, of drugs into places like Fiji and New Zealand, to a situation where drugs are actually being manufactured in Fiji by China-linked syndicates. So having a policing cooperation agreement like that is actually quite useful. And there's a reason why, despite being pressured to scrap the agreement entirely, the Fijian government said, no, 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 we want to keep this agreement in place because we need to work with China. And from where I'm sitting, it would be ultimate hypocrisy for us to say, we'll scrap all these policing agreements, because the AFP, the Australian Federal Police, they're going to Beijing all the time because we need to work with them, because our criminal problems here in Australia are linked to China's criminal problems. We have to work together. Otherwise, on a whole range of fronts, it's going to be out of control. The problem is, and this is also the problem Fiji takes, is China, like many countries, only cares about crime that hurts China. And so if it's drugs flowing into Australia or the United States, is it a first order priority for Chinese police? No.
Yeah, we're speaking on a split screen, so, but it's kind of interesting that, I mean, we all know it, but the fact that there is this duality and split screen quality to international policing cooperation and lack of cooperation, because it was in the Pacific, Australian and Chinese police can often be in the same zip code, but aren't necessarily working together at all. We have a question from I fear I'm going to mispronounce your name, so I give my apologies in advance. And I also tell everyone who's listening online, we've got about 5 minutes left. If you want to put some extra questions into the chat, we're happy to take them, and we can do a rapid round at the end. So we've got Malau Van Dranen Glisman, and I wonder if you could answer this in about a minute, and then we've got another question that's coming in. The question is, It's going to be hard to answer in a minute, though. How can the U.S. support Taiwan in maintaining regional relations, open brackets, in whatever form, close brackets?
Yes, that's a great question. Yeah. And I would almost flip the question and say, because here's the blunt truth about Taiwan. Taiwan doesn't really care about its Pacific allies anymore. It knows it's going to lose them sooner or later. At some stage, and they don't have the clout on the international stage to give Taiwan what it wants in a geopolitical sense. So in a way, a country staying with Taiwan is more in the US's interests than it is in Taiwan's interests. So the support, it may be the other way. Like, how can the US convince Taiwan to put in more of an effort in these Pacific countries? Because they really are not sending their best people. From what I can see, they're sending their best people to DC. I mean, we do it as well. Gordon's there in DC, so
flattery will get you everywhere. But I think that's a really, really good point, and especially pregnant for the United States, where, as I said earlier on, two of the three countries that still recognize Taiwan in the Pacific are two of the three freely associated states. And, you know, as Camilla, who I've referenced previously, has written about in her work, and we've written some together, these are countries in which the United States has a huge geopolitical interest in. It's the real estate that goes from Hawaii all the way over to Philippines and Japan. Ambassador Ribeiro has a question, which is, how can networks like Red ALC China and BRICS assist peace building in the region? Thank you, Ambassador.
That's a really, really good question. And certainly BRICS is a forum that people don't talk about a lot these days, but it is really, you know, one of those bodies that just keeps on chugging along. In terms of peace building, that's one of those words I'm not entirely familiar with. Gordon, what do you think he means by peace building?
So I think it's one of those terms that I think that can mean everything to all things to all people, but I presume it's like conflict resolution efforts in it. And I presume one of the answers is like peace building, advocating for it at a kind of global level. Ambassador, we're going to have to zip as a former Prime Minister of Australia once said. So unfortunately, we've run out of time. Graham, thank you very much for taking the early shift with us this morning. At 6 a.m. in Canberra when Graham started. We really appreciate your insights and the engaging way in which you deliver them. And for everyone watching, really appreciate you taking the time to watch with us and to listen with us. As I said, anyone who's registered for this event will receive a packet all of the material that we talked about during it. But for now, I'm going to wish you good afternoon where we are. Good morning to Graham. And thank you once again for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.